This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A ban for life in the NBA that everyone in America is watching. Also this hour, a step forward for democracy in Iraq that nearly no one in America is watching right now. We'll also take you inside EPA regulations to show how environmental policy is becoming a battleground over the question of federal power over the states. And we'll lighten the load at the end of the hour with a look at low-tech invisible ink and how even thousands of years ago, humans were trying to elude the ancient world's versions of the NSA. That's right. But first, in the world's largest industrial nation, the modern world's oldest continuous democracy with unrivaled protections for citizens under the rule of law, the nation that in our time also incarcerates the most people in the world, with the most people on death row among the G7 nations, who executes more people than any other country in the world after China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq. Yes, I'm talking about the United States of America, and I'm talking about what happened yesterday in Oklahoma.
At approximately 7:06 hours, inmate suffered what appears to be a massive heart attack and passed away.
That is Robert Patton, director of the Oklahoma Department of Corrections, at a news conference yesterday, courtesy of KTUL-TV in Tulsa. He is explaining the execution of Clayton D. Lockett by lethal injection, an execution that went badly because of secrecy laws enacted in Oklahoma and other states. To keep the ingredients of lethal injections from becoming public, it will take an autopsy to determine exactly what happened. What witnesses saw yesterday was an African-American inmate, a man convicted of rape and murder in 1999, strapped on a table. He was administered a drug. He became unconscious, then woke up 13 minutes later. Witnesses then report convulsions, violent spasms, shaking of the body, until a doctor called a halt to the execution, and Lockhart died, as was announced, of a massive heart attack. This is the culmination of a chain of events that is unfolding in many states around the country and could have unconstitutional implications for the death penalty, perhaps all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Carrie Aspinwall is with us now. She's a reporter with Tulsa World, has been following this story. Carrie, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
How does the secrecy issue that has been litigated in Oklahoma and other states, how does that lead us directly to what happened to Mr. Lockhart yesterday?
Well, you know, the issue with this is that they have no way to test these drugs. In many cases, what's happening, the reason that they've lost access to the drugs that they had previously used for executions that went very smoothly without these kind of issues, is the manufacturers didn't want to be associated with lethal injection or did not want their drugs, which were intended for surgery and for helping people, to be used for lethal injections. So the state of Oklahoma and others began to have difficulty obtaining the drugs, and they turned to other sources, other means. And that's how we ended up with the combination that was used last night, which in that specific dosage and combo, to our knowledge, had not been used in a U.S. execution before. Apparently, Florida uses something similar and has used it, but they have different doses slightly.
And the uncertainty relates to these secrecy laws, and the court seems to have been concerned about the cruel and unusual questions or some of the legal issues here, but the governor ordered this execution to go ahead, overriding the court in Oklahoma. What goes on there?
Yeah, there was kind of a messy showdown last week with the Supreme Court initially issuing a stay in Oklahoma. Mr. Lockett was actually supposed to be executed last Tuesday after his execution had been stayed once before. And that's how we ended up with two today. But the governor intervened and said, they've overstepped their boundary. Only the Court of Criminal Appeals can issue a stay. I'm issuing a stay, and we're having both executions this Tuesday, which there were supposed to be two last night. And as we know, there was only the one and did not go as planned.
We've already seen in the U.S. criticism of other lethal injections that looked very, very bad in what happened during the execution. Witnesses reporting concerns that people seem to be in pain. We had an anesthesiologist on this program who predicted that something would go wrong in another state. Is the entire lethal injection framework here that seems to have been set fairly stably in law for decades, is it suddenly being called into question by incidents like this?
I think so, because there is no way to properly test these first. I mean, the inmates end up being the guinea pigs. And I've witnessed several executions in Oklahoma before with the previous combinations. And this never happened. They went very smoothly. The person was obviously not in pain. They just went out, went to sleep, and then within 10 to 12 minutes were usually declared dead. You know, they have told us it was because of a collapsed vein, and I'm not sure. There's always a possibility that they could come back and say, well, it was only the collapsed vein. If that hadn't happened, it should have gone as planned. But how do we know that until they effectively test it out on another inmate?
Finally, what is it about the politics of Oklahoma that has made this such a sort of battleground for this issue before we go?
We're a law and order state, and we are actually the number one rate of incarceration for women per capita in the United States, and men were usually in the top 4 and 5. We execute a lot of inmates every year. So we've just been, along with, I think, Florida, Texas, Missouri, among the states that have had trouble obtaining these drugs. And, you know, our politicians are very much tough on crime. That's how the citizens want them to be. The majority of citizens of Oklahoma support the death penalty, and they were supportive of these executions. We'll see, you know, what the reaction is to that in Oklahoma when people see how this went.
Carrie Aspinwall is an enterprise and investigation reporter with Tulsa World, commenting on the Lockhart execution that took place in Oklahoma yesterday, something that did not go according to plan. Carrie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It is an important day in Iraq that most Americans will probably pay little or no attention to, even though 4,486 Americans died in Iraq between 2003 and 2012 to get the country to this moment. Today, Iraqis voted in the country's first national election since the withdrawal of U.S. forces in 2011. Lukman Faili, Iraq's ambassador to the United States, joins us. Ambassador, welcome.
Hi, John.
So last time we spoke, you were going to run the Boston Marathon. Did you finish? Do you have a time?
I did. I'm alive. I have time, but I would like not to share it since it wasn't my best time.
Well, in any case, you finished, and you said you were running in solidarity with the people of Boston a year after the bombing, and I thought that was very admirable. And I think for Americans thinking about Iraq, and perhaps more should be, I think it's easy for Americans to be in solidarity with the Iraqi people, but it's hard for Americans to be in solidarity with the leader of Iraq right now, Nour al-Maliki, going for a third term, who seems to have divided the nation and is presiding over an increase in sectarian violence that we haven't seen since 2007.
What we have a new day in Iraq. Democracy is in action. People are being given the chance to elect their representation. We have a new chapter in Iraq. We are evolving in this democratic process, and we have our own challenges.
But does evolving in the democratic process mean the people of Iraq have to endure 27 dead from 6 suicide bombings on Monday, an escalation of sectarian violence, 1,000 dying in one bombing within the last year?
The challenge is in relation to rule of law versus terrorism. The formation of the government is a necessary step for our regeneration of our political processes. Surely you agree with me that people should have the right and the ability to select their governments, and this is what we're practicing.
Although it must be difficult as an ambassador for the government of Nour al-Maliki to deal with some of the rhetoric that comes from him regarding the Sunnis. I mean, when he calls all Sunnis terrorists and the Shiite militias, he seems to favor openly in his orientation on security, it must make it difficult for you to make this argument that the government is even-handed.
I'm not aware he has called the Sunnis terrorists. What I'm aware of is that he and the majority of the people stood with each other back in 2008 and 2007 when they stood against sectarianism in Basra city, which was primarily a Shia city, in Sadr city, which was a Shia city, in which the prime minister was leading that charge. So in a way, we're trying to build a new society based on harmony, based on political agreements. We have challenges. Nobody is denying that. These challenges, some of them are legacy, some of them are new, some of them are to do with the geopolitics of the region changing. For example, the Syrian situation. These type of challenges are not small, but we need to work with each other.
Except Americans, I think, probably have a right to expect that the trend line is going in the upward direction rather than the other way around. I'm sure you've seen or at least heard about the Dexter Filkins piece in The New Yorker describing the situation and the al-Maliki government. There's a quote in there which says that if al-Maliki wins, if Nouri al-Maliki wins another term, he's going for his third term, he'll be president for life. Do you agree with that?
The political process in Iraq makes it doable for challenging the sitting prime minister or ministers and so on. So we have checks and balances there. Also, parliament will elect the prime minister. People don't elect the prime minister. Parliament will do that, and they are not from the same walk of life. They're from different diversified backgrounds, ethnic religions, and so on. So I think it's a bit too early now to talk about the prime minister. Let's have the election today. Let us have some joy as the democratic process is being renewed, and let us stand with each other. We have major challenges in security. The United States can play a significant role in supporting its own national security as much as Iraqi national security. We all don't want to have create a safe haven for al-Qaeda and their affiliates in between the borders of Syria and Iraq. So I think we need to focus on the challenges rather than just try to personalize issues.
Well, I'm all for a joy over democracy, but if you read closely the piece in The New Yorker, Nouri al-Maliki was not so much a product of democracy, but was in fact handpicked by an Iranian-based Shiite militia activist, Qasem Soleimani, who selected him and who basically calls the shots in Iraq. Do you believe that Iran has turned Iraq, and this is another quote from The New Yorker, into a client state?
Certainly not. Iraq has a good relationship with all its neighbors. The Iranians have a large border share with us, very similar to the Canadian and the Mexican to the United States. So that's what we have. And the prime minister was there prior to the 2010. And even in 2010 elections, he had over 89 members of parliament. So he was somewhat elected by the people, I would say.
Ambassador Faley, before we go, you have family back in Iraq, of course, yes?
I do, yes, of course.
Who are you most worried about in this current climate of violence?
I'm worried about all the Iraqis, to be honest. I'm worried about all the new generations. We need to move away from the current culture of terrorism and violence. We need to have more normal life in relation to across the whole country. Majority of the country now in the north and south and so on have peaceful lives, but they need to have development. United States can help us in our development. It also should help us in our security. So I'm would say that I'm not worried about a specific person. I'm more worried and keen for the peaceful development of my nation.
Well, let's hope this democratic step gets you closer to that vision. Ambassador Luqman Faley, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Much obliged.
Luqman Faley is the Iraqi ambassador to the United States. Later in the hour, more This Is Where poems from you about the places you love. Arielle is from Brooklyn, but I wonder if she's dreaming of somewhere else with these words. This is where the fire starts. Soft rain slips down a blurry window pane behind a nondescript plaid shirt, mostly blues and greens, a highlight of canary yellow. Looking out, this is where she learns to fly. There are places in Brooklyn that fit that description. Call us with your poem. This is where 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us your special place. More later this hour.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So, banned for life, period.
Effective immediately. I am banning Mr. Sterling for life from any association with the Clippers organization or the NBA.
The commissioner of the NBA, Adam Silver, yesterday seeking to end the scandal over Donald Sterling's recorded racist comments. The owner of the LA Clippers will pay a maximum $2.5 million fine and seek a vote from all NBA owners. The commissioner will. He'll seek a vote from all NBA owners, in theory, forcing Sterling to sell the Clippers. Slate's Jamel Bowie joins us now. Jamel, welcome.
Hello.
So we're done, right? There's a consensus in America. Racism is over with. We found the guy. We're done.
Right. No, Sterling is the source of all racism. He's like the Sauron for racism. No, the kind of open hatred Sterling expressed is pretty rare in the United States. But the sort of things that he did as a landlord, as someone who owned property, are very common, and that is sort of aggressive housing discrimination. Maybe what's not common is explicitly barring people of color from renting or owning in your buildings. But certainly the DOJ has found many instances of disparate treatment when it comes to African-American and Latino tenants, has found many examples of policies, exclusionary zoning rules that seem designed to keep minorities out of particular areas. So, you know, aggressive Bull Connor style racism, probably over, but the subtle institutional racism is still very much with us.
But what is the responsibility of something like the NBA? I mean, I think we have in the United States a fairly proud history in the modern era of sports being a progressive showcase for racial progress, leading the way in some cases, getting people sort of culturally involved in the issue of racism, even when the battles were very, very difficult in Congress and on the streets in school desegregation, for instance. Jackie Robinson is a great example. Is sports a good place for examining America's cultural progress on the question of race, or is it a symbol that just conceals more than it reveals?
I actually think sports is a pretty decent way of engaging race, of sort of making plain racism. You know, most Americans aren't paying attention to housing discrimination data. They aren't looking through stats on the disparities in the death penalty. All of the, like I said, more subtle things that you kind of have to be looking for and see. Instances of racism in sports, everyone watches sports, football, basketball, you name it. And when those issues come up, they reach a huge audience and they provide a potential for really diving into the bigger issues for people to say, look, you know, you can see Donald Sterling, but here are the kind of actions Donald Sterling took. Here are the kind of issues that are still going on around the country that aren't specific to Donald Sterling.
Well, let's listen to – this is a fairly typical response from one of our listeners. We've – you know, everyone has an opinion about this, and a lot of them sound like this listener here.
Hey, my name is Joshua, and I'm calling from Austin. I mean, my take is just whether it's the NBA who does it, you know, legally, or whether fans and players and coaches and people just do it by market pressure. There's just no way that this guy can continue to own an NBA franchise. No way. There's just got to be something done. He doesn't belong owning an NBA team.
So that's a very virtuous statement. Market pressure will keep Sterling out, and that's probably true. Certainly we saw sponsorship pressure motivating the NBA to take some very serious action here. But it's not like Nike is going to pull out of some sponsorship deal and there's going to be more affordable housing in Compton, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, I think it would be good for Sterling to lose the team. I believe the NBA definitely thinks that, since his continued presence is a bit of an existential threat to its business. But right, that in some sense, this is a symbolic action for Sterling to lose his team. And it might actually obscure the extent to which getting that racial inequality is a real thing, that these racial disparities still exist, and that getting rid of a very loud, flamboyant racist doesn't change any of that. In fact, you could get rid of every loud, flamboyant racist. No one could ever speak a single word of racial prejudice ever, and it would still be the case that, for instance, African-American preschoolers are punished at a far greater rate than their white counterparts for lesser offenses in the classroom.
Is there an image resolution problem here in that, you know, if you can focus on a single pixel, and that's what these recordings actually allow you to do on TMZ, I mean, there's so much sort of social media data out there of people saying things offhand, that, you know, you can find a lot of incriminating evidence, but there's actually a lot of big evidence right out in front of us of racial disparities that we completely ignore every day.
Right. Racial disparities are one of the things I focus on in a writer, and perhaps it's the case that I'm just like so into it that I see them all the time. And I can kind of forgive most people for not seeing them because, A, they're not very sexy. You don't really see CNN reports on death penalty disparities. It's hard to personalize them. There usually isn't a villain. The insidious thing is that this is just sort of how the system was set up. And so it keeps on moving through its machinery without really anyone necessarily putting in some sort of racist input. There's no there's no person behind the curtain manipulating everything.
And we should note, adjusting a brand is not revolutionary change in America. And that's what happened with the Clippers. The Clippers won last night. Are you a Clippers fan or are you a Washington Wizards fan, Jamal?
I don't watch a lot of basketball. So, I live in D.C., so I'm going to say I'm a Washington Wizards fan. But that's like the loosest, fan in the loosest possible sense.
Jamal Bowie, a Slate staff writer on politics, policy, and race, commenting on the Sterling story in the NBA. Lots of you have something to say about the Sterling debacle.
My name is Harvey Madison from Austin, Texas. Frankly, with the NBA situation with the Clippers, I think the players just go out onto the court, stand there, let a goal be scored on them, and then resume play. That way they can continue to be their best, but they can also protest at the same time.
Yeah, this is Jacob from North Carolina, and I would like to point out that, the First Amendment guarantees his freedom of speech. So did he actually do anything based on his racism, or did he actually, just have something to say? I don't think any action should be taken against the man, regardless if anybody agrees with it or not. It is a free country.
Speak to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Help is available at 1-800-REPUTATION or at reputation.com.
Markets and the weather, they are in unison this week as nasty weather seems to have put the brakes on first quarter GDP numbers in the U.S. The growth rate just 0.1%, a hair shy of the opposite of growth, which would be shrinking, which would signal recession, right? But there are other signs that optimistic investors and economists and the Federal Reserve are looking at in this confusing moment for the U.S. economy, and spring may still be ahead of us, weather-wise and economically. Diane Swank is chief economist at Mesirow Financial. Diane, welcome.
Thank you.
So this is, a pretty marginal increase in GDP. We were once leading the world in economic growth, at least in the industrialized world, according to the Fed. The markets seem to have cracked this all up to weather. Is this seasonal or something deeper?
Well, it is largely seasonal in the sense that the underlying final sales, which is closer to demand in the U.S. economy, actually increased at 0.7%. Still weak, but closer to what we thought it would be in overall GDP growth during the quarter. We also know that the initial cut of GDP is done on the most available data, which was data in January and February when the weather effects were the worst. That said, I can take it with a grain of salt. I'm not sure that the Fed is on quite a, I think they're on more of a low salt diet than I am, and they have to deal with these headline fingers more than I do. I can say we're going to see revisions. It looks transitory. It looks like it's not a complete reflection of the data. But when the Fed has to sit today and actually describe the economy, they have to say, well, the actual numbers were not so great. And so many people who are hoping the Fed would sound a little more optimistic about the economy today may be disappointed.
From your perspective as an economist, do you think we're in a growth trend, a solid growth trend, or are we in more of a turnaround, a transitory period, in which case quarterly GDP numbers are outliers?
Quarterly GDP numbers are outliers. I think we're going to see a big snapback in the second quarter, and we've already seen it in things like vehicle sales, the stuff that people were hibernating and they couldn't get out, and then they did get out. We also have seen it in migration trends. Not only are summer vacations booked really strong, but people were booking so strong for sunny vacations when the weather was so bad that they saw things like Disney World raise their prices 4 months earlier than usual this year. I think that's very important to understand. It means that the weather deferred, displaced, and we saw it not destroy economic activity. I think that's important, defer and displace, but not destroy.
What do you make of this week's ADP numbers on private sector jobs? That's a larger, more long-term bet on the economy, more than 200,000 jobs.
Exactly. And on that front, we're actually looking for the jobs to be fairly good in the month of April with some catch-up related to the weather, even exceeding the 200,000 mark. And I think that's important as we're looking for some catch-up in activity. We could easily nibble at 4% GDP in the second quarter after this negligible, which likely to be revised, 0.1%, almost flat, almost a goose egg on GDP in the first quarter. So it's a roller coaster ride on the headlines. But the reality is we all live this winter. It was not fun for those of us who had to live through the worst of the winter storms and the sub-zero temperatures, but it did have an effect on our spending patterns, and now everything's moving in the other direction, which is more positive.
Finally, with the exception of Amazon, earnings season shows that corporations have a whole lot of cash. Does that figure in here?
You know, corporations do have a whole lot of cash, although investment was very weak in the first quarter. We know some of that was because inventories were drawn down. That's actually good for the rest of the year, so we don't have that overhang going into the rest of the year. And we do know that, again, more recent data than this data suggests that investment may be coming back. We say may very cautiously. I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to see corporations put a little more money where their mouth is and invest more in our future this year as we really do see the economy come back from the weather and the frozenness many of us experienced during the winter. That's the good news. The bad news is we want to see it very robust because there's been a real shortfall in our willingness to bet on the future in this economy.
So sort of a frozen half smile in Diane Swonk's snapshot of the U.S. economy.
There
Thanks so
go.
Much.
Thank you.
Diane Swonk is chief economist for Mesirow Financial. Find South Florida on a map. Find Miami, then find Miami Beach, and then just travel north to where it ends in the Atlantic. This is where a man named Eduardo Lis found a safe place at a tough time.
This is where I walked with nothing, unemployed, Walgreens bathing suit. Where I later splashed full of love and peaches. I go, it's there. No questions, no answers. Vast ocean, open winds. The roundness of the earth. I am just feeding the sand. I could be foam. The beach to be alone, breathe, to be together, laugh, to be in love, kiss, to dream with clenched fingers. The beach to bury your head in the sand or have the courage to do cartwheels.
Eduardo Lis listens to The Takeaway on WLRN Miami. His poem was selected by the WLRN audience as a finalist in their and our This Is Where, O Miami Poetry Festival. People submitting poems with the words This Is Where, describing a place that has meant a lot to them. And we've featured one each week in this National Poetry Month. Eduardo Lis, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're talking about a place within a place within a place there in South Florida. Describe.
Yes, well, you put it really well. I didn't think of it that way, but yes, I'm talking about the beach. And basically, when you are at the beach, you can see the roundness of the earth. You feel like you're standing there on top of the planet. Then inside of that, you are in a beach, a specific beach in Miami Beach. And particularly the beach that I went to was the North Beach, basically between 71st and 75th Street near Collins. So that was basically my hangout place, especially when I first came to Miami 8 years ago.
I know it very well. And what about that beach welcomed you when you really needed some welcoming?
Yes. It was great because not only it's a fairly low-key beach, it's kind of quiet. There are people were playing volleyball on the beach, and they were very friendly. So basically, you can just ask and they'll invite you to play, even though I'm not the greatest player. So that talks very well about them. And so I started playing beach volleyball and I met a lot of people that way. But also like just the beach, just walking up and down the beach, going to the pier. So it was a very welcoming and also free place to go, especially when you have no money when you first come here.
And you really were in a world of have-nots, a very, very close to a place, you know, South Beach, where there's paparazzi everywhere and celebrities and fashion shoots going on. And just a few steps away, you found this sanctuary that really helped you at a pretty bad time in your life.
Yeah, it was, definitely that's the difference between the North Beach and the South Beach. There is the glamour of South Beach is not really there in North Beach. It's more, I don't know if you want to put it more like a family oriented or just people that want to relax. So it was, it was really, really came very well at that time in my life, in which I did just needed to a place to not feel lonely and a place that I wouldn't be judged as far as money and, you know, what car you have.
And what was going on in your life at that point?
Well, I had just basically come to Miami. I was, I would say I was pretty alone. I had some issues in my love life. And I also was waiting for my work permit. So basically, I couldn't really work. I was a teacher before, and I was waiting for that. And the transition is... it's not easy here, so I had to wait for a while. And it felt like a long wait, but the beach basically made it a little bit easier.
Did you bury your head in the sand in certain moments and do cartwheels in others?
Exactly, yeah, many times. There being the bad times, and you kind of don't see things going your way that you want to bury your head in the sand. And then I met, and I fell in love, and I met my wife. And then I guess I was eating peaches and doing cartwheels, like in the poem.
Eduardo Lees, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
To see the other audience pick finalists from WLRN's contest in South Florida, visit WLRN.org. They'll be announcing the winners of their contest later today. And for more, this is where poems from around the country, head over to thetakeaway.org/series/thisiswhere. We've been featuring one of your poems each week. Another big Supreme Court decision this week, and it brings us right back to one of the major focuses of the court in the past few terms, the argument over federal authority to compel the states in everything from health care to financial regulations. The Environmental Protection Agency has become a symbol of this constitutional tension. With broad powers to regulate across state lines, the EPA has been the target of challenges to its authority in cases that have proliferated during the Obama years. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled 6-2, saying the Obama administration's aggressive regulations on emissions from coal-fired power plants are consistent with the Clean Air Act. The court affirmed EPA authority over a challenge from the coal industry. We're joined by Coral Davenport, energy and environmental policy reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Coral, welcome back.
It's great to be with you, John.
So this it really says, and Ginsburg was the writer of the majority opinion, this really says that the regulations the Obama administration is putting forth are consistent with congressional intent on the Clean Air Act. And does this settle the matter?
Certainly it settles the matter for this particular case, John. What was so interesting, too, is that this was a 6-2 majority on a court that, as you know, is typically, you know, split very clearly between the liberal or conservative wings. So we saw, you know, a significant majority of the justices saying that the Environmental Protection Agency is sort of fully empowered, fully authorized to put out these very strong regulations under the Clean Air Act. And that has big implications, not just for this particular regulation, which involves controlling air pollution that wafts or drifts across state lines, but certainly for a lot of the other big Clean Air Act regulations that are coming out, as you say, are kind of becoming a signature of the Obama administration. And sort of most of all, what people are looking at are big climate change, global warming regulations that are coming out. The Obama administration is going to try to use the Clean Air Act and the EPA to crack down on global warming, which is going to be huge. And so people are looking at this and saying, this really opens up the landscape for the administration to actually go ahead and do that, which is a very big deal.
Well, in legal terms, constitutional scholars say that the national security realm and the environmental realm are the ways in which the federal government is increasing its authority, and there's been a lot of political pushback there. We're talking about the coal industry being the plaintiff in this case or mounting the challenge. That involves a lot of political organizations and constituencies that have long been critics of climate change and environmental policy. If you're talking about the coal industry, are we talking about the Koch brothers financing this lawsuit, that sort of thing? Is this a defeat for that whole group?
This is a huge blow to the coal industry and indeed also to the political advocacy groups that have been campaigning aggressively, both in terms of signing on to the legal lawsuit, but also in terms of funding advocacy campaigns aimed at overturning lawmakers who support the EPA, aimed at overturning EPA regulations in Congress. This has been an all fronts battle, both in the courts, in Congress, on the airwaves, in political campaigns, funded by a wide variety of industry groups. The Coke industry is among them. Also, major coal groups, companies like Peabody Energy, all aligned in this big all-fronts push against these EPA regulations. Really, really big blow to them with this Supreme Court decision. And this Supreme Court decision is actually one in a series, again, of recent legal rulings finding that the old Clean Air Act really does have the authority to push back on these regulations, and particularly to push back on the coal industry.
You know, and that's why Justice Roberts really went with the majority here, because in a case where he's got a clear law to look at, the ideology of the court fades, and it's really about congressional intent. And here, at least Roberts seems to think it's pretty clear.
Yeah, so what legal scholars say about this rule, and again, this is why it has broader implications going forward. You know, the Clean Air Act, which was written in 1970, you know, and passed by Congress, doesn't say specifically how the Environmental Protection Agency should write these regulations. It sets forth a lot of things that the Environmental Protection Agency needs to do, things that it needs to govern, things that it needs to pollutants that it needs to rein in, kind of broadly. And then it's the EPA's job to say, okay, we're going to write these regulations. The law doesn't tell us exactly what the regulations should say and exactly how they should be written, but it tells us we have to write the regulations. So, you know, the EPA kind of takes the authority to interpret and figure out and write out these regulations. And the nature, the way the regulations are written, that's what gets challenged in the courts. And this Supreme Court decision essentially says, even if the regulations aren't specified in the original law that was passed by Congress, it was clear that it was Congress's intent to give EPA that authority. You know, EPA has the leeway under the law to, you know, to create these regulations. And if they seem reasonable and economically reasonable, then it is the agency has the authority to write these regulations and put them out.
And that's this decision. That's this decision. Do you think the big showdown going forward before we go is going to be the question of carbon, whether the EPA can just regulate carbon?
Well, that part's been decided by law already. A series of legal decisions has given the EPA the authority to regulate carbon under the Clean Air Act. That part is settled. The next step, and which is quite similar to the question that we've seen under yesterday's decision, is, okay, the EPA has the authority to regulate carbon under the Clean Air Act. How does it write that regulation? What does that regulation actually look like? What does it say that coal plants and coal plant owners are going to have to do? What does it say that states are going to have to do? What are the details of that going to be? The law doesn't say, but this Supreme Court finding seems to indicate that the courts are going to give the EPA the authority to interpret that as it wants. So this is a real, as we see the EPA go forward to regulate carbon pollution, to go after global warming, the advocates of those policies say they really see this as a very heartening decision.
Certainly a legacy decision for the Obama administration. Coral
absolutely.
Davenport, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much.
Sure. Great to be with you.
Coral Davenport is energy and environment policy reporter for our partner, The New York Times. You can join this or any of the conversations always going on at The Takeaway. Everyone in our listener response network signs up to get daily texts, and you can too. We ask you a question featured on the next day's show, so your voice becomes part of the on-air conversation. All you have to do is text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. We've got a fun little exploration of yin and yang here at the end of the hour. Actually, we are more concerned with the yang of the written language. For every pencil, there's an eraser. Every black pen mark, some whiteout. For every keystroke, there's a possible delete. Can't have one without the other. And from the moment people began using writing to transmit messages, the annoying and miraculous properties of written language created a demand to erase or hide messages, to control who sees it. The power of language being written down is also its weakness. It's written down forever. How can I selectively send a written message? Secret couriers can be bribed and bought. Email addresses can be hacked. The NSA gets everything, right? This cultural tension about the written word is behind an amazing new book, Prisoners, Lovers, and Spies, the story of invisible ink from Herodotus to Al-Qaeda. Historian Christy McCrackis is the author. She's a professor at that mecca of robotics and software design, Georgia Tech. She says what's so fascinating about invisible ink is how low-tech it can be. As simple as one part lemons, one part hot air.
lemons, as you mentioned, are the old standby. You can use, if you don't have lemons, you can use limes or orange juice or any kind of citrus juice. And it's as simple as when you were a kid. You just squeeze it out. You can get a Q-tip or a toothpick, and you dip it in, and you write your message on a piece of paper, and then you let it dry, and then you put it over heat, and lo and behold, poof, you see a secret message.
And the more complicated chemistry in invisible ink?
Oh, one of the more complicated ones I found in the Stasi archives used something called cerium, which is a rare earth metal, and it sped up the process, so you only left a small amount of the substance on the piece of paper, so spies could use it much more effectively than lemon juice. Plus, there was only one developer, so lemon juice isn't good for spies because you just put it over heat and you can see the secret message.
But boy, those East Germans certainly, you know, cerium.
Yeah, have you ever heard of it?
I've never heard of it, but I've heard of the Stasi, that's for sure. The the interesting thing about your book, Prisoners, Lovers, and Spies, the story of invisible ink from Herodotus to Al-Qaeda, when somebody uses invisible ink, a child, they're really walking in the footsteps of the ancients who've, you know, used invisible ink going back centuries.
Invisible ink is very old. It goes way back to the Greeks or to the early modern period. The Greeks used something which in one way was more modern. They would hide things on a wax tablet and scrape away the wax, and you'd have a hidden message underneath. So that was really hidden writing, and it's similar to what people use today. Like Al-Qaeda, they use what's called digital steganography, and they hide messages in photographs attached to an email.
And how would you say the digital world has enhanced the interest in hidden messages as opposed to making it obsolete, which is what you would probably think off the top of your head?
Well, yeah, some people think invisible ink. They think of lemon juice and children, but it's actually a very important part of spying. And the digital world has taken the ancient Greeks and just used a much fancier technology for the same principle.
Do you think the digital folks will come up with the stories of hiding messages that can match the ones that you came up with from the ancients, from World War II, from really down through history?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I uncovered the fact that they thought Al-Qaeda was hiding digital messages in pornography, and it turns out they were pornographic messages on websites. So it's in use now, and the CIA won't talk to me about it because it's so sensitive.
What about the World War II era, which seems to be sort of the golden age of spies a la Le Carré?
Well, you're right. Yeah, well, the World War II era was a golden age of spies for invisible ink as well. And America didn't want to enter that war at all because invisible ink isn't just a matter of defacing a piece of paper. It's a matter of intercepting mail. So they had to launch a whole office of censorship in order to intercept the letters that had secret messages on them. And then you had this hidden war between the Germans and Americans, and especially the British.
Who was particularly good at using invisible ink down through history?
The British. Their history goes way back to the early modern period with Queen Elizabeth and Mary, Queen of Scots. But then in World War I and World War II, the British were superb at using secret ink, and they were enamored with the whole business. They took it very secretly, and they won the secret ink war with the Germans.
I mean, I guess if you're going to win some war, the secret ink war is a reasonable consolation prize to the loss of your empire, right?
That's right. Well, I mean, actually, you mentioned the word empire. It was all closely related to empire. 100 years ago, the British, as you know, did have an empire, and they had colonies dotting the whole world. And they claimed that they could intercept mail across the whole world. They said they had a grip on the world's correspondence. And that's precisely what the NSA is really doing now electronically with blanket surveillance.
And the Germans weren't slouches here. I mean, you mentioned the Stasi from the Cold War period in East Germany, but the Germans during World War II had some pretty interesting techniques.
Yeah, they developed very sophisticated techniques. The trick was you could use a simple thing like a medicine or whatever, but they developed more sophisticated techniques so people couldn't develop the ink.
Well, I mean, I'm familiar with, you know, Nazis as dentists, you know, causing great pain during the Nazi period. But there's a dental element here to your ink story, which is pretty fascinating.
Oh. That's one of my favorite stories, is the Nazi spy who hid invisible ink in his tooth. So there was a Norwegian coal miner who agreed to work for the Nazis, and they parachuted him into England, and he landed in a field, and they caught him, and they said, well, do you have any secret ink? And at first he said no, he denied it. And then he was detained in an interrogation center, and he lost the cap on one of his teeth. And so he had to kind of confess what happened. And then they found another little baggie with quinine in his molar. And so they took it out and found that he could use that as an invisible ink. Of course, it's, you know, a lot of these methods, you think, God, did they really use them? I mean, you have to go to a dentist in order to use your secret ink.
What does it say about our interest in writing and communication that, we've had this very long-standing interest, almost obsession with the secret messages, invisible messages, hidden messages?
Well, in the world of espionage, secret communication is key. I mean, if you can't communicate secretly, there's no espionage. There's no spying. I mean, you've got to communicate with your agents, and usually your agents are in some foreign country or you don't want someone to intercept their messages. So you have to have secret communication. I mean, it's totally essential. So aside from the fact, but we also have this kind of childlike sense of wonder, like, cool, a secret. We got to uncover what it is.
Have you ever used invisible ink?
Oh, yes. Yep.
Would you like to tell me about it? Would you like to share?
Share. Well, aside from having fun with it and writing secret messages, you know, you can write personal romantic messages as well, right, if you're shy about expressing your thoughts. Of course, I want to be able to communicate secretly. You know, if you don't want Big Brother listening to you, right, you're tempted to say, well, maybe I should just use the old-fashioned way and communicate with secret ink if the NSA is going to read all my mail, right?
So the NSA may be causing a boom in sales of invisible ink recipes of all kinds.
You are right, exactly.
Christy Makrakis, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Christy Makrakis is professor of history at Georgia Tech, author of Prisoners, Lovers, and Spies, the story of invisible ink from Herodotus to Al-Qaeda. Tomorrow on the program, I know we promoted this today, but we will tomorrow be talking about the White House's new initiative to combat sexual assault on college campuses.
Hi, this is Savita from Greenville, South Carolina. I think that the university should play a huge role in trying to counter issues of sexual harassment and provide a safe campus. Safety and security are primary. Even academics is secondary. And I say this as a mother of a college student at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. And I'm also a college professor at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina.
Your comments and the conversation continues tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION or at reputation.com. TiVo, maker of the TiVo Romeo, bringing cable TV and streaming apps together in one unified and searchable experience. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.